You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They called it urban renewal, clearing away long-standing neighborhoods to make way for a great big new freeway. But those neighborhoods demolished for freeways in the 1950s and the 1960s were often the heart of a city's Black community. So homes were lost, businesses, churches lost, and hundreds of people would have to move out and find a new place to live. That's what happened in Lansing in the 1960s. The Historical Society of Greater Lansing is now focusing on the history of that Black neighborhood lost to I-496 with a project it calls Paving the Way. With us is Bill Castanier, president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing, and Adolph Burton, a lifelong Lansing resident. He lived in the neighborhood demolished to make way for the freeway. It's a pleasure to welcome both of you to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Adolph, start by, if you would, describe the neighborhood, the community that was displaced by this freeway. I guess take us on a walk down Main Street or St. Joseph Street.
Yes, I can do that. Well, originally I was born on Olds Avenue, which is approximately two or three blocks from St. Joe Street. And we moved because Oldsmobile purchased our home, and then we got in the I-496 corridor. Now, in that neighborhood was our local dentist, our doctor, where we purchased our groceries. My grandmother's house is right about three blocks away, as well as the church we all went to. So it was a neighborhood that was pretty self-sufficient.
And so everything was there, and I imagine you had large family constellations in the neighborhood.
Yes, we did. That's correct.
And when the I-496 project was announced, can you remember the community's response to the fact that basically what? People were told this neighborhood's going away.
Well, at that time, I was about 16 or 17 years old, and I wasn't really into politics that much and was being a 16 or 17 year old, you know, just getting in high school. So I wasn't really attuned to that too much. But as I look back now and think about that, a lot of people were just kind of passive to it and was accepting of it. And then there were others who were pretty much an uproar about it. So it was kind of mixed emotions. I would say probably 60 or 70% of the people were kind of going along with it.
Bill, as the president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing, give us a little bit of context here as far as why this decision was made, and particularly how it came to be that people were just moved out of their homes.
Okay, the highway history in our country goes back at least to the 1880s, actually.
Sure.
I don't think we want to go back that far. But in the 50s, there was a move nationwide to build expressways, or divided highways, as they are often referred to. And there, it was led by President Eisenhower. So as early as 1956, they had selected 80 cities that would be targeted for an expressway. Lansing was one of them. Black Bottom in Detroit was one of them. Almost every major city was selected for a highway. The two most notable ones that decided not to do this were San Francisco and New Orleans. They just said no after much disagreement. But one of the attractions to it was the federal government paid 90% of the cost. 10% was paid generally by the state, and the city of Lansing, for example, spent less than $500,000 to have an expressway through the center of its city.
So if you were at all inclined to want to have that easy transportation and you were in city government, this was served up on a silver platter.
Oh, it was. And city planners loved this idea. They thought they could do some social engineering. At the time, the areas they went through were either called slums or ghettos, and those were the words they used. And they thought by eliminating slums and ghettos, they could accomplish two things. They could make it easy to get from one end of the city to the other and move people throughout the city, then disperse people.
And just to kind of break it down quickly, dislocating these neighborhoods, paving them over, putting in the freeways— break down briefly the chain of events then that really wound up sending white people to the suburbs.
Exactly. When they first decided to instigate the expressway system, they thought this will bring people into the city. Well, what most planners forgot is it also took them out very easily. It takes 7 minutes to go from one end of Lansing to the other. 7 minutes, that's all, on a snowy day. So what it did is everyone had to move within a very short period of time. And when we're talking to everyone, we're talking more than 650 families that were in the Black neighborhood. So once their home was purchased, they had 45 days to vacate that home. That created it actually created a tremendous turmoil in Lansing. First, there was a housing shortage. And secondly, blacks could not live everywhere yet. So that didn't happen at least until 68 and probably into the 70s.
Right.
So 650 families had to be located almost overnight, and that was a tremendous problem within the city. Once they moved, they triggered white flight in many neighborhoods. First black family to live in a neighborhood, white families started selling. And so by default, Lansing became desegregated. It wasn't pleasant at the time, wasn't pretty. There was a lot of difficulty making those relocations happen.
Where did you go? What did your family do when you your house is sold? You it's stunning to stop and think. For over 650 families, you had to be out in 45 days.
Well, I tell you, most of the people in our neighborhood moved to the south side of town where a new housing project was already under development. I would say, I don't know, maybe 60 or 70, maybe even 80% of the people went there. But what my family did, my dad and my mom, purchased one of the homes that was getting torn down by the I-496 project right down the block, purchased a lot across the street at the north side of 496, dug a hole, and put the house on that. So we just moved right across the street. And the house is still there today, as a matter of fact.
Still
there. My sister still lives there.
Oh, my goodness. Bill, why this project now? Where'd the push come from to do Paving the Way?
Well, I think it came from the Historical Society's recognition that this is an untold story. This is a neighborhood. Everybody identifies with neighborhoods. And no one really outside the black community knew about this neighborhood anymore. It's been 50 years almost. You can drive down the expressway, tens of thousands people do, and you don't think of what was under it or over it. And we wanted to tell a story of a time and a place that is totally gone. If you probably go back to your neighborhood and it's still there. The people that live there go back to that neighborhood, and it's pretty hard to point out, except for Adolph, where they lived. You know, it's gone,
it's
totally
gone.
But the stories aren't gone.
And the stories aren't gone. And here we have this project, Paving the Way, research project, and so many ways you're going to do this, including oral histories. And I know, Adolph, you've been involved in that. Tell us what that was like for you.
Well, I tell you, it's very interesting as well because, as I said, I was only like 15 or 16, 17 at the time. So I'm learning quite a bit myself and a lot of interesting stories about places that I was a little bit too young to go to, like some of the nightclubs and restaurants that serve liquor. And so I'm hearing about those, as well as some of the people that were not so attuned to the move were very rebellious and very militant about that. I was very surprised at that, too, and they were saying that it had been redlining and some political issues as well. So I'm learning quite a bit myself.
Bill, when you stop and explain to us how quickly the city went in and raised this neighborhood after announcing the project and just, you know, buying the houses, what challenges does that present for building this archive and this documentation?
Well, one of the things is when you move from a house, you leave a lot behind or you don't take it. So some of the history is gone, but it's surprising how much was saved. Now, we're at an age where people have not lived to see what we're doing. So we're right at the cusp of losing a lot of people, and so it's really important we get this done in the next year or so. But I think there's enough stories that are oral traditions that still are out there that we're gonna grab, that'll be there forever, we hope. And, you know, 50 years from now, somebody can say, I can go and find out what it was like to have lived there. It was a very, very, one of the things we're finding out is the neighborhood was self-contained, but it was a great place to live. And they weren't slums and they weren't ghettos.
In fact, I'm interested in taking you into what you're learning as you see this lost neighborhood through the eyes of the people who lived there, Bill. What has surprised you the most?
Well, one of the things that surprised me, and I lived in Lansing during that period of time, so I understood what was going on. But for example,
but you were on the outside looking in.
I was an outsider looking in, and one of the things I learned very quickly was there were 8 churches there that were torn down. That was the center of the community. But one of the churches was, the pastor was the uncle of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King preached at least twice in that church. I did not know that. I don't think very many people outside that neighborhood knew that. That's a phenomenal thing. We also just recently learned there was maybe a half dozen homes and businesses that operated as boarding rooms that were in the Green Book. So we're learning stories, and we're going to be able to carry them on for a long time. I learned that there was a pretty famous jazz musician, Big Nick Nicholas, who was famous enough that Coltrane wrote a song about him called Big Nick. There's stories like that that go on forever, and thanks to people like Adolf, who knows everybody in the community. That's the other thing. Everybody knows each other. So if you talk to one, they'll say, you need to talk to this person. And without Adolf, we wouldn't be doing this.
And isn't it fascinating that we're hearing this? We've certainly we've heard this story repeated from Flint. I've had conversations with someone who lived in a neighborhood that was totally gone to make way for an oil plant and its parking lot. You pointed to the Black Bottom neighborhood in Detroit, gone for I-375. And now we're hearing kind of a sense that maybe these freeways weren't so good for our cities. We're cut off. People can't walk around. People can't do the things they want to do in 2019 because there's a great big ribbon of moving concrete in front of them.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that's happening around the country, I think Atlanta might be one of the first places it's happening, is they're building ramps across them, reconnecting the neighborhoods. There were 35 streets dead-ended in Lansing. So on either side of those streets, neighborhoods were gone also, not just in the Black neighborhood, but 35 streets. They're noisy. Lansing, interestingly, is not elevated in any way, so that's probably good. It goes 20 feet under grade in some areas, but what happened is that created a funnel where noise just came out of it like a speaker. So they're not pleasant to live next.
Was there a new bill just passed to change the one-way streets coming up part of this time this year?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, thank you.
What's that? Tell us about that.
The mayor of Lansing, new mayor, decided that he had enough of one-way streets in Lansing. We had probably a dozen one-way streets. He's changing seven of them back to two-way streets. The one-way streets were created for off and on ramps.
So that's at least some reverse engineering, we should say.
There's a reverse engineering.
We'll forget how to get around.
Tell us what will be in paving the way. What are some of the components of this project?
Well, we're doing the oral histories. They're going to be both video and audio. We're going to do at least 50. We may do up to 100. We're going to create an online interactive map. Ours will be online. You'll be able to click on an address or a house, see what the house looked like, see who lived there, and then see where they moved. Attached to some of those will be oral histories about that house or the business or whatever. We're also going to local churches and gathering ephemera and photographs and scanning them, because we want to do a temporary exhibit in the Library of Michigan for probably a month or 6 weeks. And then what we'll do is we'll take it on the road. We're going to have a traveling exhibit. And we're actually creating what is referred to in history now as a lost archive for that neighborhood. And that'll be available in a scrapbook form online and in print. But we're finding things like the day after we announced that somebody came with a 97-page scrapbook for us of the history. So those things are out there. We discovered one of the most surprising things that we discovered, and Adolf can mention it a little bit, is his father was a photographer. He has tens of thousands of images from that neighborhood. It's absolutely amazing, and he's hung on to them. So we're going to be able to scan those, put those in an archive so people can see it forever.
A historian's gold mine. Adolf, tell me how that feels to, here we are 50 years some later from when this all happened, and to have this spotlight back on your neighborhood. How does that feel?
Well, I tell you, it's really a wonderful feeling, because as Bill said, my stepdad just passed away about 18 months ago. And we had lots and lots of family pictures, as well as pictures that he took of weddings and other events that took place in our community. And we just didn't know what to do with them. So a friend of mine, Derek Quinney, introduced me to Bill, who was working on the project, and we kind of got a marriage going there. And a lot of the pictures are, some of them are posed, but the best ones are the ones that are not posed, where my dad just took candid pictures of people. And some of them are some of the first Black doctors in our city, dentists, lawyers, And so they're really, really, really nice pictures of them when they were in their 20s, just graduating from Michigan State. So they're really nice pictures, and I'm really enjoying them. My dad would really appreciate that.
That's wonderful. What do you hope, Adolf, people who see the photographs, hear the oral histories, what do you hope they're going to take away from paving the way?
A way of life that was taken away. That's my biggest concern right there. You know, because, and I've said this over and over and over, it's not a black thing, it's not a white thing, it's not an Oriental thing, it's not a Mexican thing. If you got to build a highway, you got to build a highway. But at the same time, you took away a way of life. All the churches, all the dentist's offices, all the bars, all the restaurants, all the nightclubs, my grandmother's house. Just do a little bit. You don't need to take them all away. And that's what I'm taking away from this is, I tell you, it was just so nice back in the day, as they say. And I always say this, where your neighbor could spank you if you needed a spanking, you know. those kinds of things. Everybody looked out for everybody. You know, the corner guy at the store would give you credit. You need a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk till payday. And all that's just gone.
Well, the project is paving the way, telling the story of the impact of the construction of I-496 on Lansing's African-American community in the 1960s. And you can find out more by going to lansinghistory.org. And we want to thank Bill Castanier, who's president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing, and longtime Lansing resident walking history book, Adolf Burton. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.